The United States Court of International Trade is now in session. The Honorable Gary S. Katzmann presiding before court number 21-00281, Best Mattresses International Company Limited et al. Versus the United States et al. Will the attorneys please state their names for the record, starting with the plaintiff?
Good morning. Sarah Witt on behalf of Best Mattresses, plaintiff Best Mattresses et al. From Maury and Grimson.
Renalda Smith from Maury and Grimson.
Morning.
Morning, Your Honor. Chair Westerkamp on behalf of the United States. I'm joined by Ashlyn Dellen from the Department of Commerce.
Morning.
Morning, Your Honor. Chase Dunn with the law firm Castle & Buchanan on behalf of Mattress Petitioners, defendant interveners in the case.
Morning. Please be seated. Welcome, counsel, and understand that you have worked out among yourselves. Of course, the court issued a letter on January 22nd, questions for oral argument. Court is also in receipt of the responses by the parties. The plaintiffs will have 20 minutes for oral argument, and the defendant and the defendant interveners are splitting the time, the 20 minutes. And my understanding is that the defendant will have, is it 12 minutes or 8 minutes?
10 minutes, Your Honor.
10 minutes. Oh, so you're splitting it evenly. Okay. And defendant interveners will have 10 minutes as well. Okay. So why don't we begin the argument?
Your Honor, would you like us to address all of the questions in a row, or are we going back and forth?
No, it's really within your discretion, but you have 20 minutes. You can, if you want, make an opening statement as part of it. And this is your chance, of course, also to respond or rebut the questions that are presented by the defendant, the government, and the defendant intervener. So,
thank you, Your Honor.
You'll have 20 minutes, straight. Thank you.
Good morning again, Sarah Wiss from Maury and Grimson on behalf of plaintiffs. Thank you for the opportunity to come before the court again in this case. I will discuss the two open issues in rebuttal to defendants' responses to the court's oral argument questions. First, commerce's exclusion of non-market economy countries and countries with broadly available export subsidies from the calculation of Best Mattress's input costs. I'll refer to these countries collectively as the contested countries. At the outset here, I want to remind the court of the other countries we're dealing with here. First, of course, we have Cambodia, a market economy country and the place of production and exportation of the subject merchandise. Then there is the group of five countries, Turkey, Malaysia, Brazil, Mexico, Romania, and Russia. These are the countries that commerce determined produced mattress inputs, such as quilt or foam. Commerce used GTA data for these five countries to calculate an approximate cost of production, or COP. These I'll refer to as the input COP countries. And they are also market economies, or were at the time of this investigation, as is the case with Russia. So defendant and defendant intervener push a narrative that the court should look at Section 773C of the Tariff Act, or 19 U.S.C. 1677B(c), and sources stemming from that section. There's no basis for this. Section 773C only applies when, and I quote the statute here, The subject merchandise is exported from a non-market economy country, end quote. Here we have no exportation of subject merchandise from a non-market economy country in Cambodia or in the input COP countries. This is critical because the presumption of unreliability that we are going to discuss today and that Your Honor posed in its questions, in your questions, comes from that section of the statute and that section alone. And second, I will discuss Commerce's continued use of the flawed Emirates financial statement in its remand. Turning first to the NME presumption and question one to defendants. The court notes that in the remand redetermination, Commerce reversed course and excluded these contested countries from the GTA data, noting that Commerce cited its, quote, longstanding practice, which it did not rely on before the remand order. And the court asks if that reversal was impermissibly conclusory or if there was a reasonably discernible path. In answering no, that it is not impermissibly conclusory, and yes, it's discernible, defendant claims that Commerce provided examples of past practice in market economy cases as support. That's simply not accurate, and I will rebut each source briefly. First, Commerce cites to the petition in this case, in which petitioner excluded imports from the contested countries in approximating normal value. This site is not persuasive, nor is it relevant, because Commerce's standard for initiating a petition is much lower. They simply must have reason to believe or suspect that imports are less than fair value. It's not the same as Commerce's duty under the statute to actually calculate a respondent's normal value as accurately as possible. And tellingly, Commerce just cites to the petition, but no reasoning by Commerce in the initiation notice, for example, to suggest that Commerce actually considered this issue or considered this presumption of unreliability. Second, Commerce cites to its practice of not using NME producers when it selects surrogate financial statements in the constructive value context. That's true, but it's not relevant. It's a different inquiry. So when Commerce selects a surrogate financial statement to calculate profit and selling expense ratios, it is trying to replicate a producer of subject merchandise. In that context, it's reasonable not to use an NME producer because Commerce generally disregards the costs of NME producers of subject merchandise under Section 773C. But the inquiry at hand is different. Commerce is estimating the cost of production of inputs that are used to produce subject merchandise in Cambodia. It doesn't matter if the inputs are sourced from a non-market economy or a subsidized, a country with subsidies, because the subject merchandise producer is operating in a market economy and is presumed to operate under market principles. Third, Commerce relies on the diamond saw blades from Korea case. That's 71 FR 29310. So yes, Korea is a market economy, but this case does not support Commerce. In fact, it supports our position. There, petitioners pushed for an adjustment to the Korean respondent's costs based on its Chinese inputs, but Commerce actually refused to make that adjustment. Commerce mentioned in that case that it generally assumes that prices for goods produced in NMEs cannot be relied upon for purposes of a price-based analysis, and that's the language that defendant and Commerce latched onto. But that determination goes on to very clearly explain that presumption is within the context of Section 773C, meaning only where the subject merchandise is exported from a non-market economy country. So because it was a market economy case involving a Korean exporter, the Chinese inputs were deemed reliable. Fourth, Commerce cites to CTL plate from Romania. That's 69 FR 54108. Romania is now considered a market economy by Commerce, but before January 2003, Romania was a non-market economy. So Romania was in that NME period when Commerce determined not to rely on the input prices from the respondent's Indian suppliers because of broadly available export subsidies in India. That case does not support similar treatment in a market economy case such as this one. Consider, how would Commerce treat that same Romanian CTL plate producer today? Would it automatically deem its Indian input prices unreliable based on some general presumption? We all know the answer is no, and I suggest asking the other side for their opinion on this.
Well,
that presumption...
we've read your filings. So what is your home run case?
On this issue, Your Honor, the home run is the statute. Commerce is going contrary to the statute. The normal preference under the statute and the presumption is to use a market economy producer's own costs, own records. Everything that Commerce cites to here is all within its NME methodology. So on this issue, our home run is stick to the statute, and without any sources or citation to the statute in a market economy context, the determination cannot be upheld.
And in terms of a judicial decision, what is your home run judicial decision?
The home run judicial decision on this issue, what can I point, Your Honor, to? In this case, I would have to, Your Honor, I would have to possibly go back to my notes. There are some more than average number of cases that we're discussing today. So I don't have that in my outline, but I can possibly find it when I have time to come back up for a minute.
Sure.
If that's okay. But briefly continuing on, I just want to point out that Commerce also cites to this wind towers from Vietnam case. Again, another non-market economy case, not relevant here. So defendant intervener in its responses yesterday to the court's questions, they make similar points but also made this statement in response to the court's question that bears highlighting, and I quote. They said, the department determined that the presumption that the data from NMEs in countries with broadly available export subsidies are distorted applied with equal force to affiliated and unaffiliated suppliers. Commerce most certainly did not make that statement. The court asked Commerce to explain its presumption, if its presumption applies with equal force to affiliated and unaffiliated suppliers, but Commerce failed to directly address that. Maybe the government will answer it today, but likely Commerce didn't make that direct statement because it would be contrary to the Act, because there's no general presumption against NME prices or prices from these subsidized countries. Commerce is simply wrong to claim that it never uses, for example, Chinese prices or Indian prices or Indonesian prices. It does. If Best Mattresses purchased the same Chinese inputs from an unaffiliated supplier, there would be no presumption of unreliability. Finally, I just want to point out that the particular market situation allegation in this case nicely illustrates the general rule, and that was the record document we added to the appendix yesterday, PR 238. If there was a general presumption of unreliability of all NME prices across all investigations, petitioner would not have had to file a PMS allegation claiming that the Chinese inputs into Cambodia distort the market, but it did, and Commerce rejected that allegation, explaining that Commerce's longstanding practice is to calculate costs based on the records of the producer in a market economy case. So for these reasons and in our written comments, Commerce's determination remains unlawfully conclusory, unsupported by substantial evidence, and not in accordance with law.
In terms of the appropriate standard of review for this court,
Standard of review for this court is to review whether the remand redetermination is in accordance, consistent with the remand order, as well as supported by substantial evidence and in accordance with law.
And what kind of deference do we give the agency?
The agency is accorded the same deference as in the initial case, but their determination has to be reasonable. Even with deference, it has to be reasonable. It has to be in accordance with law, and it's not in this case. Moving on then to the financial statements issue and question number two that the court asked of defendants. That question was whether there was precedent for Commerce's average two financial statements to account for flaws in both statements. So defendants and defendant interveners cite numerous cases that stand for Commerce's preference to average ratios for multiple financial statements, even if all statements have flaws. These cases are not controlling for several reasons. Again, we are case law heavy in these issues. And for several reasons. First, this is not a choice between two equally flawed statements. First, you have Grand Twins International Statement, GTI. The GTI statements represent production in a preferred foreign country, Cambodia, and merchandise that is similar, if not identical, to the subject's merchandise, thus fulfilling the requirements of the constructive value section of the statute. Commerce identified no internal flaws with the GTI statements. They are accurate, complete, show a profit, and are contemporaneous. On the other hand, we have the Emirates financial statements. The Emirates statements, while for a mattress producer, are incomplete, show evidence of subsidies, and are not in the preferred foreign country. They come from India. Importantly, there's no argument anymore whether the Emirates statements are incomplete. That's now an accepted fact. So there's really no choice here. GTI had a single less than ideal attribute. It represents similar but not identical merchandise, and Emirates had three flaws: incompleteness, evidence of subsidies, and location outside of the preferred country. The scorecard is not tied here. The record only contains a single usable financial statement. Second, Commerce has a practice of excluding incomplete or unreliable statements from its multi-statement average. Two cases to point the court to. First, as explained in the Dorbass Federal Circuit case, 604F3D1363, Commerce's preference is to average multiple statements, quote, as long as those financial statements are not distortive or otherwise unreliable. So the Emirates statement fails that test. It is unreliable and should not have been included in an average. Further, the facts in the NTSF seafood joint stock case are analogous here. And we'd like to point the court to the 2022 decision, which is 2022 Court of International Trade Lexis 40. It's later in time than the 2020 decision cited by defendants. There, in the 2022 decision, Commerce departed from its two-statement preference because it identified problems with both the quality and completeness of one of the Indian financial statements and therefore reasonably decided only to use one. The court upheld this use of a single statement. Similarly here, the only reasonable determination is for Commerce to remove the Emirates statement, even if that means departing from its preference for a multi-statement average. Third, even if this is a choice between two flawed statements, Commerce had an obligation to choose the best one. I'd like to point you to the Shanghai Tainai case. That's 658F3D1269, cited in our comments yesterday. That was issued by the court after our last remand comment, so just, I believe, in September of 2023. In that case, Commerce did not abide by its preference of averaging multiple financial statements, but instead chose one. The court upheld Commerce, recognizing Commerce's practice is to choose, and I quote, the least bad one when ranking flaws. Commerce reasonably rejected the statement with more worse flaws, as it should have done here, and the court referred to that as the ugly dog contest. Here, Commerce needed to kick out the ugliest dog, the Emirates financial statement. Also point the court to the CP Kelco case cited in our comments yesterday, which was a Federal Circuit case providing that Commerce must, quote, consider the weaknesses of each financial statement and decide which is the more serious flaw. This is the exact analysis that Commerce should have performed here on the Emirates statement, and it failed to.
Now, with respect to the argument by the government and the defendant interveners that the information missing in the Emirates statements would not be vital, since it would relate to a different country, India, and a different market, What's your view on that?
Maybe I'm not understanding correctly, Your Honor. The question is their position that the information is vital, the missing information is vital?
Would not be vital.
Would not be vital.
Yeah.
Well, our view, as it has been throughout this case, is that the missing information is vital because it speaks to, we know it speaks to a subsidy. It's an annex that speaks to a subsidy. What's not known, and this gets to question three to the government, what's not known is whether information in that annex would prove that the subsidy was one found to be countervailable by Commerce in a past determination, which is the standard that that Commerce uses, as Your Honor mentioned in question three. So, but they couldn't make that determination.
Okay.
So a couple more points on question three, which we've really already turned to. So we actually agree with defendants' statement in response to this question that Commerce generally does not rely on financial statements where there's evidence that the company receives countervailable subsidies when there are other sufficiently reliable and representative sources on the record. That's what we have here. There's evidence of subsidies, and we have another reliable statement on the record, that of GTI. But then defendant explains that Commerce's policy is not to reject every statement that simply mentions a subsidy. It has to be one where Commerce has found countervailable in the past. As I mentioned, the problem with that is that Commerce cannot perform that test. It can't determine whether this is a subsidy that has been countervailed because the information is missing. But instead of presuming that the annex contained a disqualifying subsidy, Commerce provides petitioner with a beneficial inference, assuming it does not include a disqualifying subsidy. The only reasonable determination was for Commerce to infer that there was evidence of this subsidy. I mean, the treatment is starkly different from the adverse inferences typically applied to respondents when there's missing information. So just hypothetically, I'm not making any allegations here, but if there was evidence that the annexure had a disqualifying subsidy, that would be a good page to leave off the record. And Commerce should have presumed, as it does with respondents regularly, that information omitted is actually damaging to the submitter. So Commerce had no reasonable basis to view the Emirates statement in such a generous light, and it acted without substantial evidence by continuing to use it instead of relying on the GTI statement. So I think I have 30 seconds remaining, but I'm happy. That concludes my comments, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Oh, that's I think you've answered our questions. We will give you an opportunity to maybe come back for about 3 minutes or so.
Thank you, Your Honor.
After you hear the arguments. And is Ms. Smith also arguing?
Ms. Smith is not arguing today. Right. She's just supporting.
Right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hear from Attorney Westerkamp for the government.
Good morning again, Your Honor. So just to dive right in to rebut the written responses from plaintiffs that were filed yesterday, we do think they appear to still be advancing the same argument that the court had previously rejected. And at the pin site of the court's remand opinion at 1385, the court had held that Commerce had failed to justify the presumption of non-market economy and reliability applied in the affiliated supplier context, but not in the affiliated context. And so here on remand, at the remand results at pages 26 and 27, Commerce explained that their practice in market economy cases is to not use surrogate values from non-market economy countries to determine the constructed value of profit and selling expenses. And so that's why, pursuant to and in compliance with the court's order, Commerce reconsidered that on remand and removed the non-market economy countries from the global trade atlas data that Commerce was looking at. And so I would also point to the statute 19 U.S.C. 1677B, if I could read my handwriting, F1A, where, again, it is Commerce's practice, again, to exclude the non-market economy data even when it's in a market economy investigation. And then turning to question two, again, This is at page 28 of the remand results where Commerce explained that it didn't change its practice. In the final determination, it had used a simple average, and the only difference on remand was Commerce excluding the non-market economy countries. And plaintiffs, importantly, point to no record evidence that a weighted average methodology would somehow be more accurate. They claim that Commerce should do weighted average because that would allegedly lead to more accurate dumping margins, except the problem is there's nothing on the record that actually shows that, that a weighted average would be more accurate. And also...
Even if a weighted average would be more accurate, does that mean that an analysis which does not take account of a weighted average or rejects a weighted average should be disturbed?
No, if I'm understanding the court's question. And I think the court had even acknowledged, and this is at Penn site 1350, where Commerce's normal practice is always is to apply a simple average. And I think that if there was any record evidence that a weighted average would be more accurate, which there isn't, it's still, the court should defer to what Commerce did. And it's also, I think in this instance, a reweighing of the evidence that the court should stay away from, where again, Commerce explained why the simple average is its preferred practice, and the court sustained that originally. And again, the only difference is pulling out those non-market economy country data in the remand results. And with the third question regarding the public availability of the Emirates statements, I think the plaintiffs, as they must, concede that reopening the record is largely committed to agency discretion. And a predominant case on that is SR Steel, 678 F3rd, 1268, and that's the Federal Circuit case from 2012. And a more recent case from this court, Shandong Ronsing, probably mispronouncing that, but 203 F3rd, 1327, and that's from this court in 2017.
The pencils case.
And I should learn how to pronounce some of these cases better. I always feel like I'm fumbling over it. And so more importantly, the reopening the record, again, largely committed to Commerce's discretion, but unlike what plaintiffs argue that it's somehow new surrogate value information, and it's not. It's the same financial statements, so the Emirates sleep, but merely what Commerce allowed mattress petitioners to do on remand was to explain if it's publicly available, and that's what mattress petitioners did, where they did go through and had a step-by-step explanation of how the data can be accessed, both from the MCA website, which is an Indian government authority, as well as from the Zalba Corporation website, which then leads into responding to the fourth question, where, again, plaintiffs concede, as they must, that substantial evidence is the standard for public availability. And plaintiffs essentially, I think, make an argument that there's no evidence on the record that the Emirates fleet financial statements were available in 2020, except there's no record evidence that they were not available in 2020. And Commerce explains in the remand results on pages 22 and 32 and 33 that on the Zalba Corporation, so basically the financial statements, I believe, were certified December 16th, 2019, and then the data was available for 8 months, so through August of 2020 for when this administrative review started. And so basically they're trying to say there's no evidence that it was available, except there's no evidence it was not available. And importantly, what Commerce, and the court had noted that one of the flaws of the Emirates sleep statement was it was uncertain if it was publicly available, because last go around, the only information was that mattress petitioners had obtained the financial statements from an Indian consultant. But again, on remand, they very detailed went through with a step-by-step chart of how you can access the data. And so with that, again, it's within Commerce's discretion to open the record. None of it's new information. There's no argument that somehow the ratios have changed. The only thing that did change is that there's a robust explanation now as to how it's publicly available. And I would briefly touch on when it comes to the averaging of the statements. Again, it is Commerce's practice to use multiple statements to the extent there are any. And I would point out that part of why Commerce does that is because it leads to more reliable data, and averaging financial statements helps to eliminate any potential distortions that may arise. And the Federal Circuit has affirmed that general practice, and that's one of the many Dorbest cases at 604 S. 3rd, 1363, from Federal Circuit from 2010. And again,
and so is the affirmance, does it proceed through the lens of abuse of discretion?
With the court reviewing it, or
in terms of the you know, the way the court analyzes what the agency has done?
I mean, I think with this, there has to be yes, abuse of discretion, but also is there substantial evidence to support for Commerce's use of it? And with the financial statements, that is always going back to, again, what's the best available information on the record. And although the GTI financial statements were from Cambodia, the country of that's at issue here, even, you know, the court had said in its remand order, part of the problem with the Emirates sleep was the public availability and the incompleteness. And also the GTI, although it's from the same country, was not a producer of mattresses. So in this instance, Commerce did have two flawed financial statements, and explained on page 16 of the remand results that it was going to use both of them and just, again, use that simple average, which another case I would cite for that would be the Dongguan Sunrise Furniture Company, and we cited that in our response to the court, and that's 865 F sub 2nd, 1216 from 2012. And if the court has no further questions, I don't have anything else.
I have no further questions.
Thank you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Again, Chase Dunn with the law firm Cassidy Kent. I think I'll just dive in and add a few points to that great presentation from my colleague, Kara, well, at the table at least. So let me address question one. I think the plaintiffs have misread the court's remand order and continue to assert that Commerce's presumption that data from NMEs and export subsidizing countries are only, that presumption is only applicable in the NME context, but it's not, and the court found as much in the remand order. This court recognized that when calculating constructed value, Commerce will normally use a respondent's records, but only if those records reasonably reflect the costs associated with the production and sale of merchandise. In the final determination, Commerce held that it could not rely on the respondent's records for purposes of applying the transactions disregarded in major input rules because those transactions were between affiliated suppliers in the non-market economy, and therefore resorted to using surrogate values instead of the respondent's records. And the court affirmed Commerce's decision to reject the respondent's records because they were based in an NME, and affirmed Commerce's use of surrogate values. Now, Commerce did not exclude data from NMEs and export subsidizing countries from the surrogate value data, which is why this court remanded to Commerce to explain whether it applies that same presumption under the constructed values section of the statute to affiliated and unaffiliated suppliers, and Commerce made clear that it does in the remand order. So it was perhaps light in its reasoning, but it's clear that it was responding to the court's concern about whether it was applying that presumption under the constructed value statute equally to affiliated and unaffiliated suppliers, and Commerce said that it does. I'd like to move to the second point, although some of this is proprietary, so I would just refer the court to our briefs about no change in Commerce's methodology. It's essentially the same thing, just no NME and export subsidizing countries. Again, I will just add that Commerce typically uses a simple average, as it has in this case, and I would direct the court to the fine furniture case, which is directly on point here. It's 353 F sup 3D 1323, and it has facts almost identical to this case. With respect to question three, the argument that Commerce's decision to reopen the record was extraordinary and inconsistent with prior practice is completely without merit. This court has repeatedly acknowledged that Commerce has the discretion to reopen the record on remand, which it often does. I'd be happy to provide citations to cases where Commerce reopened the record and collected additional information or itself put information on the record in order to address issues that were remanded to the agency. Contrary to this being extraordinary, Commerce's actions on remand were quite ordinary and consistent with practice. Now, with respect to question four, when it comes to whether the court has to instruct Commerce to reopen the record, I think it's clear that the court does not and that Commerce has that discretion. But I'd like to point out that Best Mattresses appears to have raised a new argument in their response to the court's question that it had not previously raised, which is that the filing date, the 12-16-2019, of Emirates' financial statements referred to the date that those were filed with the government of India, not when they were placed in the public registry for review. It's not clear to me that that argument was raised in comments on the remand. If that's the case, which I believe that it is, then that argument is waived. But even if the court considers it,
when you say it's not clear to you, is that a polite way of saying that it has not been raised?
I think, to be fair, they have argued that the financial statements were not available at the time of the administrative proceeding here, the investigation. So kind of as a general matter, that argument was made. But specifically that the filing date on the MCA or the Zalbacorp website, referring to only the date that it was filed with the government, I'm not aware that that argument, I didn't see it in their comments on the remand, both draft and final, and so it's not clear to me that that particular specific argument was raised. But even if the court considers it, the date shown on both the MCA, which is official government registry, and the Zalbacorp shows December 16th, 2019, and you can find that that date refers to the date that it was publicly available to members of the public, because it also filed the director's report that was filed on September 29th. If you go to Emirates' financial statements, the director's report was finished, completed on September 29th, 2019. It was only uploaded to the MCA website as part of the financial statements on December 16th, 2019. So it's clear that those dates refer to dates that they were available, and they're the same date in the Zalbacorp as the MCA, showing that you can get them from both places. But even if the court thinks that this argument is debatable and that the factual record is debatable about whether the filing date refers to when it was filed with the government or not, when the factual record is debatable, Commerce gets the benefit of the doubt under the substantial evidence standard. So, and I would just add two very quick points that the plaintiffs have asserted that Emirates' financial statements contain evidence of subsidies. This is completely false. Emirates' financial statements refer to balances with government authorities. That is not the same thing as a subsidy. It's entirely possible that nothing in those balances is a subsidy. We don't have the annex, so it's hard to know. But Commerce's practice is not to disregard financial statements simply because they refer to balances with government authorities.
Is it possible that balances with government authorities connotes subsidy?
I don't think as a general matter, no. It could refer to any kind of balance with the government that has no relation to a subsidy whatsoever. I'll give two examples. These balances are on the Emirates, on the asset side of Emirates' financial statements, which we've talked about before in the prior remand, which suggests it's not a loan from the government, it's not a grant from the government. But even if, I would also note that the plaintiffs have not cited a single Indian CBD case indicating what could potentially be hiding in that annex. They have asserted that it's subsidies, could be countervailable. Not a single Indian CBD case has been cited that would fit in the asset side of Emirates' balance sheet and would be recorded as a balance. So I think it's speculation to assume that that balance is a subsidy. We don't have the annex, so we don't know. But you shouldn't make an assumption either way that there is a subsidy or that there's not. And I think I have 2 minutes left, and maybe I'd reserve the balance of my time unless the court had any additional questions for me.
You don't have to reserve the balance of your time if you want to, continue. I will provide all parties
an opportunity
for rebuttal.
Okay. I guess I'll address one more point, which is the plaintiff's assertion that GTI's financial statements are not flawed. But they clearly are flawed because the company does not produce not just identical merchandise, but not even comparable merchandise. Commerce found that it produces some similar merchandise, textiles, garments, those kinds of things. So it's clear that Commerce has two financial statements that are flawed. And Commerce's practice of averaging financial statements is explicitly grounded in averaging to address any abnormalities that may exist with respect to particular financial statements. So that practice of averaging financial statements fits the facts of this case. You have two financial statements, both are flawed, and in order to even out any abnormalities that come from those flaws, Commerce followed its practice and averaged those financial statements. And so with that, I think I'll end my opening remarks there.
Thanks, counsel.
Thank you.
So I will give the parties, I think I said 3 minutes, I'll give you up to 4 minutes to respond to what you've heard. As is my practice, I will also give the parties an opportunity to file a post-argument a submission of not more than 1,250 words. That's about 5 pages. And that will be due a week from today, February 7th. If either of the parties needs any more time, you can, you know, let me know. But February 7th. Okay. Counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor. So I'd like to start first back with the presumption of unreliability, the GTA data, and the exclusion of the contested countries. Counsel for the government pointed the court to a section of the statute, 19 U.S.C. 1677B F1A. So I pulled that up. Those are the special rules for constructive value. And nothing in there states that in the constructive value context, there's a presumption that commerce should treat as unreliable inputs from non-market economy countries or inputs from countries with generally available export subsidies. You know, that section under A actually states that costs shall normally be calculated based on the records of the exporter or producer, if such records are kept in accordance with the generally accepted accounting principles and reasonably reflect the costs associated with the production and sale of merchandise. So what is the exception that involves here? And counsel petitioners mentioned that we are in an exception to the rule, and there is an exception, and that's where if inputs are purchased from major inputs, in particular here we're talking about our purchase from an affiliated supplier, then commerce has a process by which it's going to test those prices to see whether they were market prices and they will accept them. That's where we are. Just because we are in affiliated sales, the respondent purchased from affiliates, does not mean that we jump to the NME section of the statute in commerce's normal value NME surrogate value methodology. That's the missing link here. They've taken, just because the respondent operating in a market economy country purchased from affiliates and those affiliates were located in China, then all of a sudden we're supposed to be in Section 773C of the Act, and there is no support for that. Counsel for the government, you know, reiterated the citation to where Commerce in its remand said that there was market economy case support for its determination, but as I walked through earlier, none of those cases actually are on point. So turning now to the public availability that was discussed, to remind the court that there is nothing on the record establishing that what petitioner did in 2020, how they got these statements in 2020. Nothing from their Indian consultant, no correspondence, no receipt from 2020, no 2020 screenshots. All they showed was that they could get those statements now. There is something actually on the record that we cited in our response to the comments, and that's public record document number 152, which back in August of 2020, we put on the record a screenshot showing that we could not obtain the statements. And also, it's petitioner's obligation to build the record, and they failed to do that. Turning to your, you had asked me a question about what's the case law that best supports our argument back to number one. I would point the court here to the Nippon case, 494F3D 1371, and the Timken case, 421F3D 1350. Those deal with commerce must explain its reason for reversing a policy, which it did here, and must provide a reasonably discernible path. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel. So I will give the defendant and defendant intervener 4 minutes to, you can decide how you want to split it.
Your Honor, I don't have anything, but I believe defendant intervener might.
I just have 2 points, if I might.
Sure. Mr. Mr. Dunn?
I just want to address two very quick things. First, about public availability. Plaintiffs cite to a CV rebuttal submission that they submitted in the underlying investigation, which they say shows that they couldn't find Emeritus' financial statements. If you look at that exhibit and compare it to the supplemental questionnaire that we filed on remand, what you'll see is that plaintiffs went to the MCA general website and just searched in the general search function, Emirates Sleep. But that is not where you search for publicly available records on the MCA website. If you go to the MCA website, there is a particular web page that allows you to go to the registry. When you're at the registry, if you type in Emirates Sleep's financial state or Emirates Sleep's name, as we show in our supplemental questionnaire, you can find all of their documents going back to 2006 when they were incorporated. So the fact that they couldn't find it is because they were searching in the wrong search bar on the MCA website. And that's very clear if you compare their exhibit to our supplemental questionnaire. With respect to diamond saw blades from Korea, I think it's important to recognize that the court or Commerce did not make an adjustment in that case, not because it didn't apply its enemy presumption, but because it found, and I want to quote the language here because it's very direct. They found that they didn't make an adjustment. Sorry, I got to find it here. Sorry about that. They found that actually the inputs in question were so minor that the distortion, which they called distortion, was negligible. That's why they didn't make an adjustment. And you can find that at IDM at comment 12. So the case does actually support Commerce's determination, and I just want to point out that the reason they didn't make an adjustment is not because they found enemy data to not be unreliable. It's because they found the distortions to be negligible given the size of the inputs and the overall calculation. And that's all that I have. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. I'd like to thank counsel for your enlightening submissions and arguments, and As noted, you have an opportunity to file a post-argument submission of not more than 1,250 words, and that would be due on February 7th. In that submission, please include any citations to cases that have been presented the first time during the argument here, so that we have the citations and the and a parenthetical would be helpful. So that concludes our argument. Thank you very much, and be safe and be well. Thank you.
All rise.